My name is Winston Crutchfield, your host for the Critical Mass podcast here at Critical Press Media. I've got a great conversation with author Phil Elmore coming up. And then stick around for the news and goings-on here at Critical Press Media, including Fear the Con 3 and 365 Days of Podcasting. Stick around.
Primary Reaction Chamber. Critical Parameters on Earth. Time.
Initial reaction at T-minus 30.
Fuel slug in place. Stand by for injection. Capsule breach now.
Reaction commencing.
Containment field hold to 3.14 degrees of time. Initial chambers crossing to capacity. Can we hold it? What's happening?
Critical mass.
Hold on! Mind spike!
Thing about technology? It works so much better when it's plugged in. I am pleased and privileged to welcome into the reaction chamber with me once again, Phil Elmore. Phil, how you doing today?
Good morning, Winston.
Is it as cold and wet and raining where you are as it is here?
Probably similarly, yes.
I love the rain. I love to look at it from inside a warm, dry house.
It's a great day for writing a novel.
So, speaking of novels, you have a new novel hitting the stores very, very soon, within a week or two, I imagine. And that would be Season of Harm, and this is going to be your second Stony Man novel, is that right?
That is correct. That's the second Stony Man novel that I've written. It's basically the story of two different fronts fighting the same enemy. It's the same type of storyline that I tried to do in Drawpoint. The difficult thing about a Stony Man is that you've got two teams of people operating in different parts of the world, and you have to try and find a way to make what they do essentially the same mission, or at least related. It wouldn't do to have them operating in completely different missions. You could do a story like that, but it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense.
So, with two teams and with, oh gosh, eight different characters plus supporting personnel, but you've essentially got eight main characters to deal with between the two Stony Man teams, is that right?
Yes, it makes it very difficult because, of course, the Executioner and the Super Ballin books, which are just a Stony Man-length Executioner novel for all intents and purposes, if you have one main character, you can winnow that book down to focus solely on Mac Ballin throughout, if you choose. The Stony Man novels, because they are the sort of crossover spin-off novels that feature supporting commandos that have worked with Mac Ballin in the past, you basically have to try and find a way to deal with one three-person domestic team, which is Able Team, and one, at the moment I can't remember if it's four or five, I can't really lose track, a team of commandos that operates abroad, which is Phoenix Force, and you have to somehow find enough sort of screen time for all those people for it to make sense. What I tend to do is I tend to focus on the leaders of both teams. On Able Team, it's a former cop named Carl Lyons, who's sort of a large, grumpier analog to Bolin. And Phoenix Force, it's David McCarter, who's a former British SAS commando, who is the sort of slimmer, snarkier, more sarcastic Bolin. So, by focusing on them and then hopefully giving the supporting members of their teams enough to do to show that they're there, you know, so that you don't forget them, so they don't disappear for huge portions of the novel, you can sustain the story in a way that the reader won't find tedious. If you're constantly bouncing from character to character, determined to give everybody equal play, not only will you drive yourself nuts, but the story will be really boring. So what I end up doing is focusing on the leaders of both teams and their interactions with their supporting team members in a way that shows the reader that, yes, those people are there, and yes, they do things, and sometimes those things are important or useful, but doesn't get bogged down constantly switching the camera from person to person. I tend to think of these things in very visual terms because it helps to visualize the story as you write it.
Well, it's very much like an action movie, and we kind of jumped right into things without any background for those people who aren't maybe familiar with our previous conversations. The Stony Man books are an offshoot of the Mack Bowl and the Executioner series, and these are essentially anti-terrorist task groups who it's military action fiction. For want of a better, a cleaner way of putting this, it's military action fiction, and the Stony Man imprint is an imprint of Harlequin Gold Eagle, and you can find them every month in your local bookstore and online. so that's kind of the bare bones of what we're talking about with Stony Man. You've got. Whereas Mack Bowl and the Executioner is just a single guy going up, doing his missions solo with a supporting cast. With Stony Man, you have two separate teams accomplishing, their individual things in completely separate theaters of operation. So while Able Team is ostensibly based in the United States and Phoenix Force ostensibly operates abroad, I can see how it would be really tough to maintain some dramatic tension with two completely, I mean, literally completely separate theaters of action going on. And so much of dramatic tension is lost when you have to cut away, as it were, from one scene to another. So yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from, where it helps to focus on one character and give the supporting cast their moment to shine, as it were. But yeah, so do you have any tricks or secrets that you use to keep that going, to keep the reader's attention when you have to switch perspectives like that?
Well, one of the things that dual structure affords you is the ability to do little miniature cliffhangers or even just scene breaks as you switch from one set of story to the other. So you may remember those old Super Friends cartoons. They would do a scene change and the narrator would go, "Meanwhile, back at the Hall of Justice," and that's essentially what's happening when I stop the scene, hopefully on some sort of cliffhanger-type moment, say we're dealing with Able Team, and a door bursts open and someone levels a gun and starts shooting. Well, you don't immediately address what happens in the next chapter. You switch perspective to the other team's storyline, hopefully end theirs on a similar mini-cliffhanger note, and then switch back to the former storyline in the other chapter. What I generally like to do then is switch off chapter by chapter, Able Team, then Phoenix Force, then Able Team, then Phoenix Force, hopefully mirroring the pace of the action so that you get some sort of climactic battle for both teams as you get to the climax. Another thing that transition, which is almost a forced transition because you do have both storylines to deal with, is if you want to do a change of time or a change of setting, if you want to allow something to happen essentially off camera, the perfect time for that to happen for one team is while you're dealing with the other team, because it gives the reader a sense of the passage of time. Sort of like on 24, it's presumably during those commercial breaks is when Jack eats and goes to the bathroom and, sits in cabs and does other boring things that you really don't want to have to sit through as the viewer.
Sure. I'm never going to be able to read one of your books again without hearing the narrator say those words, seeing those three dots of light zoom past the screen now.
Exactly. And that's really how I picture a lot of those transitions when I write them in my head is, okay, now I'm reestablishing the reader in a different place. Sometimes we use the convention of labels at the beginning of the chapters that tell you where you are. In a very complicated story, that sometimes helps, and you can almost picture that as you're watching it as an action movie in your head, as that text that appears at the bottom of the screen and lets the reader know, okay, now we're here. And I think if that's done well, it creates a sort of a sense of almost news documentary feel, like you're processing this tactical information that's coming into you as you're following the very, very important actions of these characters. interpretation of worse and worse as you know what's going on. I've gotten away from that as I've written more of the books. I tend to write them more as a straight linear narrative now with fewer of those scene breaks, and I use the chapter breaks as my transitions.
Well, speaking just for myself as a reader and viewer who gets easily lost when these transitions occur, I'm looking at Drawpoint right now and seeing what you're talking about, and how at the beginning of a chapter it'll say Atlanta, Georgia, or here we go, Nongstoin, West Kasai Hills, India. I find that very helpful. So maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just a convention of the genre, but there you have it. I know it's very popular. Chris Carter used that a lot on the X-Files stuff. We see it a lot on similar television shows. Law and Order comes to mind.
It also depends. Like, depending, if you're not really fast switching back and forth frantically from scene to scene and place to place, it's not always necessary. Sometimes you can just say, in the course of your narrative as you're writing, in Atlanta, somebody was doing something, and it can flow that way instead of necessarily just hitting the reader in the face with it, like, hey, stupid, you're back in Atlanta in this chapter. You know, there are different ways to do it, there are different ways to approach it depending on the pacing and the feel of the book that you're writing. I try to treat the reader with a lot of respect. I try not to assume that the reader is stupid. I know that may not be the case with every author you encounter, and sometimes you wonder, is he just selling this out for the benefit of the mouth breathers who don't understand what happened? It's the equivalent of watching a movie, and the person in the row in front of you leans to the person in the seat next to them and says, why did he shoot that guy? What's going on? Is that the same guy from the first thing? What just happened? Which is why when you watch a movie sometimes, you'll have seen something happen 15 minutes ago, and they'll feel obliged to give you a flashback to 15 minutes earlier in the movie to show you that, yes, that person shot this person because it's the same guy from the prologue at the beginning of the film. He had a different haircut, but it's the same guy. And I try not to do that. I don't ever want my readers to go, yes, thank you, I was there for that. But what I do like to do is I like to, in the epilogues of my books, generally in the sort of the debrief portion where you reassure the reader that all is well or as well as it's likely to be, I try to sum up what happened, tie up loose ends if there are some, and give the reader a sense of closure as, you know, typically as Bolin or the Stony Man teams get together with their handlers at Stony Man Farm or whoever happens to be in charge of that particular book. You know, in the Stony Man books, it's sometimes a briefing with the whole team. In the Executioner or Super Bowl novels, it would be, Hal Brugnolo, who's in charge of the farm overall. He's the director of the Sensitive Operations Group, as it's sometimes called. But it basically just gives the reader a wrap-up. It's like, congratulations, you got your way all through the novel. Here's what happened. Here's a few payoffs. I sometimes try to do little gratifying gifts to the reader. Like, this character who you really hated all through the novel, well, at the end he's getting browbeaten by the forces of good and they're telling him that he'd better comply or he'll end up in prison forever. You know, something that says, yeah, get that guy, and makes everybody happy.
That's something I really enjoyed both with Dangerous Tides in a smaller way. But especially with Stony Man, is your climactic wrap-ups, because you really work on that building that threat, building that drama for each team, and the payoff at the end of the book when it comes is just really, really nice, and I really appreciated that you handled that in such a way so that You have one team get to the end of their story arc, as it were, and complete their mission, but they still have to. I mean, it's not over yet. The other team's actions are still meaningful without rendering the first team what they did completely meaningless. Both teams have to succeed, and they have to do it. you know, one right after another. I have to do it right now. I appreciated the way that that was handled, and I wondered, as we were getting to the end of that book, how that was going to work out. And I still feel like since Drawpoint is still on shelves, I don't feel like I can talk too much about that, you know, because I really want the readers to go out and pick up a copy of it for themselves. No, I was saying go pick up Drawpoint. It's still on the shelves. Well, it's still on shelves here. and Season of Harm is coming out very, very soon. Now, when I wrote to you earlier, you said that you're right in the middle of your next Super Bowl-in, and we certainly appreciate you taking time away from Mac to talk to us. You had mentioned that he was there were terrorists and a golf course involved, and now I'm worried. Just tell me that everything worked out okay.
As I recall, the second I got your email, I was just about, we were looking over Matt Bowen's shoulder as he was crouched on a hillock on a golf course, and a group of terrorists were camped out on the greens in the dead of night, and he was just about to pull the trigger on his suppressed Beretta 93R machine pistol when I got your email. So I left him there long enough to respond.
And
you can imagine, Bowen, you know, is quite a long-distance marksman and has made many a shot that is ballistically impossible, especially with something like a 9mm, which shouldn't be able to travel some of the distances that it does. But as Mac Bowen would tell you, he doesn't put a lot of faith in those pronouncements. So, and I actually worked that into the book. You get a lot of opportunity with the type of omniscient narration that we do in these books, both to explore Bowen's sense of righteousness and the nobility of what he does, something he never questions. You know, Bowen does not ever experience doubt about what he does. He's a paladin figure, sort of a righteous warrior who never makes a mistake, never shoots the wrong guy, and always accomplishes his mission. So the challenge with a character like that, who could be very two-dimensional if you allowed him to be, is to try and make him both realistic and believable while not allowing him to be boring. Because he very well could be boring if you let him. And one of the ways around that is to pit Bowen against people who are anything but that type of character, which is one of the reasons I enjoy doing characterization of the villains that he deals with so much. You can explore a lot of sort of darkness of humanity and the motivations of why people do the things that they do when they have the mirror of Bowen's, you know, super polished good guy front. And yeah, as good as he is, he's still, you know, he'll kill you if you're the sort of person who requires killing. So that is interesting as well, because you don't want him to become this implacable Terminator who, you know, just walks into a room and mows everybody down and can't ever be stopped ever. He still has to be human, and more importantly, he's not just mortal, he has to retain a sense of humanity. He has to be a human being who is capable of feeling emotion, even though the emotion he's not going to experience is doubt or guilt. That's not part of the Bowen makeup. That's a very difficult formula when you're trying to create realistic characters. You have to make sure that he's essentially an imperfect, perfect, good warrior. And, you know, that's a fine line to walk. I think the very first Bowen novel I wrote, Vigilante One, which was an executioner novel, I like to think it's good, but I've been told by people who've read books that I've written subsequently that he didn't have as much personality in that first book as he has in later books. And that's probably true, because as the more you write a character like this, the more you get to understand his nuances of character. When I write dialogue for him, I can hear in my head the voice that I've given him, which I hope makes sense to somebody who has written a book before. I can kind of tell you what he would say in a given situation, confronted with a given scenario, having had so many thousands of words, so many hundreds of pages to get to know that character. And in Vigilante Run, I contrasted that person with sort of a darker envisioning of Bowen, a vigilante who doesn't care if innocent people get hurt because he's on a mission to avenge a dead family member. And putting those two together, you know, a man who is essentially vigilantes that must be stopped, gives the reader an opportunity to compare and contrast how those two men do what they do.
That's fantastic. See, now I'm going to have to go and track down a copy of Vigilante Run. You do this to me on purpose, don't you? Well, you certainly steered us directly back onto where I was wanting to go, which is characterization. When you're dealing with so many Iron Man type characters, all due respect to Carl Lyons. But when you're dealing with so many characters that are echoes of the Mac Bolan archetype in one way or another, I can see how it would get very, very difficult to repeatedly distinguish one from another. Because all of the members of Able Team and of Phoenix Force are these, while maybe not the perfect warrior that Mac Bolan is, they're certainly possessed of a similar sense of confidence and, you know, a similar sense of determination and of purpose and of righteousness. And in reading Drawpoint, one of the things I really appreciated that you did was that most of your characterization of the teams came through their interactions with the people around them, whether it was with the people that they are attempting to save, whether it's with the people that they are opposed to, or whether it's with the characters that are there assisting them with their mission, most of the word count, most of the time was spent on these supplemental characters. But for all that, the different members of the different teams, we really got an opportunity to see how each one is individually different from the others, and I really appreciated that, and I can't imagine that it's an easy thing to do.
Well, it is challenging when dealing with Stony Man. I mean, when you're dealing with Mac Bolan, you essentially have Mac Bolan, the support team who just put in token appearances, usually by phone, and then you have whatever villains and other supporting characters you choose to create. When you're dealing with Stony Man, it's the same scenario, except that the set cast of characters who all demand attention is now multiplied, you know, many times over. The one thing that makes it easier is that every character sort of has something that makes him special, a key personality trait that could be a stereotype if you chose to treat it as one, but hopefully if you treat it a bit more gently, it just becomes his defining characteristic. Carl Lyons is a very gruff, grumpy man. Blaine Canales, the politician, is more diplomatic and well-suited to tasks involving any sort of con-man-like activity. He's the face to this A-team of characters. And then you've got Gadgets, who, you know, is always involved with electronics work, but whose primary task, when I write him, is to tease and annoy Lyons so that you can get sort of a humorous comic relief effect from all of them interacting. The idea being that there's a sense of camaraderie among these characters, even though periodically they get much more serious and start shooting people. Then on Phoenix Force, you've got McCarter, who is very, very British, and they're always very aware of that fact. And it's also now his job to be in charge. And I've tried to give him some moments of inner consideration of the role that he now plays, because he wasn't always the leader of that team. He replaced a character who was killed off. And, you know, naturally, you would feel a heightened sense of responsibility when that role was put on you, because McCarter, before he became the team leader, was always something of a hothead. Then you've got other characters the other members of Phoenix Force also have little traits about them that make them special. Calvin James is, you know, the wisecracking African-American, you know, knife-fighting sort of cool guy member of the team. You know, the Samuel L. Jackson in their midst, if you want to characterize it that strongly. And you've got a variety of other lesser characters. I will admit I have my favorites, and there are people, especially on Phoenix Force, who don't get as much screen time when I write them, simply because I don't find them as interesting. I try not to give them short shrift. I try to make sure that we know that they're there. But I just, you know, like Enciso and TJ, I guess I tend not to deal with them as much, simply because someone. There always has to be supporting characters. Another thing that you touched on that I try to do whenever I write, it's a fundamental rule of good writing, that you do not tell the reader, you show the reader. So whenever possible, I try to do characterization and defining of the people in the novel through what they do and say, as opposed to simply telling you that they are this way. You don't say to the reader, you know, Carl Lyons was always a very grumpy cop, blah, blah, blah. You just show him acting grumpy with the people he interacts with. Exceptions to don't tell but show involve those chapters where we omnisciently get to hear the thoughts of, especially a villain character. I try to do at least one omnisciently narrated characterization chapter for my villains in every book that I write, sometimes more than one, where you get to hear from their perspective what they love, what they hate, why they do what they do. You know, they didn't just wake up one morning and say, hello, I'm evil. You know, they have reasons for why they do what they do, and often they feel justified and righteous in their activities in much the same way that the members of the Stony Man Farm teams feel justified and righteous in what they do. The difference is simply that the villains are wrong.
Well, all right. Well, Phil, I have kept you as long as I promised, and probably a little bit longer. Now, you have Season of Harm coming out real soon. Do you have any other books in the pipeline in the near future? Do you know?
Yes, I do. I don't have to have the dates in front of me. I know I have an Executioner novel coming out, and I believe, let's see, I have a Super Bowl novel called Sabotage that is coming out a couple of months from now, maybe March? I don't remember. I know I have an Executioner novel coming out around July, and another Executioner novel coming out in October. But the next novel after Season of Harm is a Super Bowl novel called Sabotage.
Okay. So we'll get ample opportunity to check back in with you in the future.
Yeah, it's a good 2010 is a good year for me. I've got a total of 4 novels hitting the shelves. You know, it's a couple of months off, and then a new book, which makes it good. It's, you know, right about every quarter, you get some more executioner fiction that I wrote, which, you know, is good for me. Granted, I'm not objective. I'm biased.
Well, you know what? You have a good reason to be biased. I've enjoyed your works, and that's saying quite a lot from my perspective. So there you have it. Well, Phil, I sure appreciate it. Phil Elmore, ghostwriter for Mac Bolan and the Executioner series of books, Stony Man, publisher of the Martialist magazine. Where can we find you online, Phil?
You can find me online at www.themartialist.com. That's themartialist.com. You can find me at philelmore.com. And I also write a column called Technocracy every Thursday in worldnetdaily.com, the conservative news and commentary website.
Fantastic, Phil. I can't say too much how much I appreciate you taking time out for me. Now, don't leave Mac hanging out too much longer. Go get him out of that mess.
Well, that's always how it goes. My job is to put him in terrible situations for the express purpose of shooting out of them, and to find wonderful tourist spots throughout the world that I can then besiege with harm, so that I can rescue them from that harm. It's a little twisted, really.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
So lots of stuff going down at Critical Press Media this year. The December release of Water is Life, the benefit book for Living Water International, is underway. So if you haven't gotten over and picked up a copy or made a donation through the Podcasting for Water feed on Facebook, go ahead and do that. It's a great cause, and you can pick up some great fiction while you're at it. Our other benefit book from 2009 was Pathfinder, and that goes to benefit the Wounded Warrior Project. Plus, you get the story of Buck Hilton, Pathfinder, and a Native American veteran from World War II. Again, great books and great history there, and a great cause. Well, the Christian New Media Group is podcasting for compassion this year, and the theme is Compassion 365. The goal of the group is to do one podcast a day for the entire year, 365 podcasts, as a way to raise money and raise awareness for Compassion International. And you can find out more about the podcasts that are participating in that, as well as more about Compassion International, ways to donate, and ways to sponsor a child, over at compassion.socialgivingpodcast.com. And that site is being hosted and administrated by John Wilkerson, the Jesus Geek. So we're looking for good things this year. We have a lot of people participating in that, and we're just hoping for that. Critical Press Media is participating in the podcast field as well, but we're also putting together another benefit book. The first benefit book for 2010 will be The Least of These, and that will proceeds from that book will go to benefit Compassion International. You can stay tuned for submission information on the website as that becomes available. But the gist of the project will be to take the scripture verse that says, "Whatever you have done, you know, for the least of the, if you have fed the least of these, if you have watered the water, you know, whosoever you have fed or clothed or sheltered, if you have done it to the least of the of these, you have done it for me." And that is the theme that we are taking for the book. The working title is going to be The Least of These, and I'm looking for stories revolving around acts of compassion. So if you have the writing bug, send it in. The benefit books are submissions for the benefit books are edited and reviewed at no charge to the authors, which admittedly is not such a big deal for professionals such as the esteemed Mr. Elmore, but is perfect for amateurs and enthusiasts and students and those who are looking to polish their writing and to break into the field to get some publication under their belt. So send me your manuscripts. The deadline is going to be June 1st, and we're looking to raise some awareness and raise some money through the first 2010 Critical Press benefit book. Fear the Con 3, March 12 and 13th. I will be at Fear the Con 3 this year. I'm going to be running games as well as playing in them. I'm really looking forward to that. I plan to be running a Rifts game, since the Palladium settings are some of my favorite material. And you know what? It's really getting short shrift over at Fear the Boot. They're picking on it a whole lot, so I'm going to show them that Rifts is fun. Planning to run a Gilligan's Island of Darkness. Well, you know, what if the characters in Gilligan's Island were inhabitants of White Wolf's World of Darkness? And, you can just imagine where all the myriad places that can go. I'm looking for a lot of fun there. Looking to do demos of the Atomic Earth board game. And if you can't make Fear the Con to check out a demo there, just go ahead and pick yourself up a copy through the website at the Critical Press website, criticalpressmedia.com. It's a great game. I'm going to be running some demos from the board game. And we're looking to do a Savage Worlds Atomic Earth adventure where I will be previewing the rules, adaptations, and settings for the upcoming Savage Worlds RPG, Atomic Earth RPG. And I'm really, really excited about that, really excited to be getting into that. Plus, there will be cool promos and stuff that I'll be giving away. If you can make it to the con, you can find out tons more about that over at feartheboot.com or at their associated site, feartthecon.com. So that's March 12 and 13th that's going to be a great time. I'm really looking forward to. Right, well, as usual, I'm running off at the mouth, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap this up, sign off. Just remind you to keep your reaction chamber fired. I promised a review, a commentary review for Blu-ray owners of The Dark Knight, and that is still underway, but I'm having some trouble coming up with 3 hours worth of commentary on a movie in which I was essentially not involved. So I think I'm going to take a different approach to that, and just stay tuned to see where we're going with that. In the meantime, I'm just gonna, I'm gonna stop talking now.
Email at mindspike@criticalpressmedia.com.
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 3.0 license.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Doom.
Let it be beep.
Yeah, that will, something beeped.
That's okay, we can edit this part out. Then what you can do is you can take this part where we say we're going to edit it out, and you can put it at the end of your podcast, kind of like when you get through the credits of the movie and they show the outtakes.
Well, that's the magic of podcasting. They'll never know what they missed.
It was up to me. There would always be a cool scene at the end of the credits of a movie. I hate it when you sit through